Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, who discusses the Egyptian military's coup derailing their nation's transition to democracy. William K. Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, who examines the causes of the dramatic decline in American family wealth in the years following the Great Recession. And Lorella Praley, a member of the United We Dream National Coordinating Committee, who talks about the importance of President Obama's executive order stopping deportations of young undocumented immigrants. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The government of Myanmar has declared a state of emergency in the state of Rakhine on the western border with Bangladesh after deadly sectarian clashes between majority Buddhists and Muslims. In recent weeks, sectarian clashes have resulted in the death of dozens of people and forced hundreds to flee their homes. Rising ethnic hostility in Rakhine began in late May when a 27-year-old Buddhist seamstress was raped and killed. Three Muslims were quickly arrested. Buddhists, who make up 90% of the population of Myanmar or Burma, stormed the local police station looking for the Muslim suspects. In early June, a bus headed for Yangon was stopped by 300 protesters and 10 Muslims were taken off the bus and killed. Mobs of Muslims have also attacked Buddhist villages in Rakhine. President Thein Sein, a former army general and opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi, called for peace and restoration of public order. Sein went further, saying mob violence could derail current political reforms in Myanmar, formerly run by a military junta. Human Rights Watch condemned the state of emergency order, which gives the military total control over affairs in Rakhine. The group is calling for the government to open the state to journalists, non-governmental organizations, and foreign diplomats. In the lead up to the Rio Plus 20 Earth Summit in Brazil, the International Labor Organization released a report estimating that up to 60 million new green jobs could be created by 2050, mostly in the developing world in fields like renewable energy. Garbage pickers who live on the margins of cities in emerging economies could gain by organizing themselves to tap into recycling technology pioneered by industrialized nations. In Europe, Germany has already invested 100 million euros into constructing energy-efficient buildings, which grew out of a three-way agreement between the German government, trade unions, and building contractors. The Green Building Initiative has already reduced energy bills, decreased greenhouse gas emissions, and created over 300,000 jobs. The International Labor Organization says that over the past 5 years, the number of jobs in clean energy production across the globe has doubled. The United States has created over 3 million green jobs, while Britain, facing an austerity-induced slowdown, has created more than 1 million new green jobs. In Brazil, 7% of the workforce is now engaged in the green economy. Akeem Steiner, head of the UN Environment Program, praised the Labor Organization report, saying the findings demonstrate that the green economy can include millions of people in terms of overcoming poverty and delivering improved livelihoods for this and future generations. New Orleans civic leaders are angry over massive job cuts at the Crescent City's daily newspaper, The Times-Picayune. The 175-year-old paper announced it's laying off half its award-winning news staff as it moves to a digital platform. The newspaper's out-of-town owner, Advance Publications, run by the Newhouse family, also announced major layoffs at its newspapers in Alabama and plans to cut print circulation in New Orleans to 3 days a week. The Times-Picayune won praise for continuing its operations during Hurricane Katrina. The newspaper recently won 4 Pulitzer Prizes for its reporting on Katrina and the BP oil spill and for uncovering corruption in Greater New Orleans. Now top business leaders are trying to pressure the Newhouse family to reconsider the newsroom staff cuts. Some major advertisers are considering pulling their ads from the paper out of anger over the layoffs and reduced print circulation. Former New Orleans City Councilor Constable Lambert Boissier says reading the Times-Picayune is a morning ritual for most city residents. In spite of the population exodus after Katrina, the Times-Picayune has retained a loyal readership. The daily paper had a market penetration rate of 65%, the fourth highest of any newspaper in the country. According to The Nation magazine, the paper made an $8 million profit in 2011. With its massive layoffs, Advance Publications is cutting production costs by 60% and is using its website to deliver local news. This in a community where 35% of the population lack access to the internet. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
As Egyptians went to the polls in the second and final round of their nation's first free election for president on June 16th and 17th, the military announced a series of decrees which crushed the hope that was born in last year's democratic revolution. Although millions of Egyptians placed their trust in the military for their role in ousting Hosni Mubarak after decades of one-party rule, it's now the generals who are clearly blocking a transition to democracy. As it became apparent that the Muslim Brotherhood's candidate, Mohamed Morsi, would likely defeat Mubarak's last prime minister, Ahmed Shafik, for the presidency, the military decreed an immediate dissolution of Egypt's elected Islamist-controlled parliament after a Supreme Constitutional Court ruling found the law governing recent legislative elections was unconstitutional. As polls closed on June 17th, a second decree gave the generals total control over governmental and military affairs until new parliamentary elections are held. The Supreme Council of Armed Forces, or SCAF, also announced that if the existing Constituent Assembly failed to complete its work to draft a new constitution, the SCAF will form its own Constituent Assembly to write a constitution within 3 months. Tens of thousands of Egyptians responded to the Muslim Brotherhood's call for a protest against the military in Cairo's Tahrir Square on June 19th. Meanwhile, ousted President Hosni Mubarak was reported to have suffered a stroke on June 19th and was close to death. Your reporter spoke with Phyllis Menes, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She discusses the Egyptian military's counter-revolution and the role the U.S. could play to support democracy.
Just moments, really, after the final part of the election, when it became clear that the Muslim Brotherhood had won, and quite overtly in response to the possibility of a Muslim Brotherhood president, the military announced that the president would essentially have virtually no power, that the president that was about to be elected would not be able to control the army, would not be the supreme commander of the military, would not be in control of the military budget, would have no oversight over the overall budget, would not have the right to declare war, and essentially would be only a figurehead. It was the most egregious, most overt sign of a absolute pullback from the military's claim that they intended to turn over power to civilian rule as soon as anybody could be elected, because after all, they didn't really want to be in charge. They were just doing it out of patriotic duty, and they thought they had to, and as soon as they could, they were going to hand power back to an elected authority. Well, when time came to hand it back to an elected authority, it turned out they didn't like the elected authority so much, so they simply announced, we're not going to do it.
Phyllis, is there any evidence that the U.S. is covertly supporting the Egyptian military in an effort to contain Islamist political forces in the Arab world's most important nation?
I think there's no question that the U.S. financially and militarily is supporting the Egyptian military. They have for 30 years, and they never stopped, including during and after the Arab Spring. Now, having said that, I have not seen any evidence or even any substantial allegations that the U.S. is actually orchestrating this coup. I think the U.S., the Obama administration, would be quite happy with a stable government civilian government in Egypt, because it's more likely to encourage greater stability in this most important Arab country. And the U.S., I think, has grudgingly, I would say, come to terms with the fact that Islamist forces of various sorts, and the Muslim Brotherhood in particular in Egypt, are critical forces that have massive support from the population, despite their claims of, you know, they would never meet with terrorist organizations, etc., and they have for many years included the Muslim Brotherhood in several countries on various lists of so-called terrorism. The U.S. officials, the State Department, has been meeting with representatives of the Muslim Brotherhood. They were here In April, they spent several days in Washington meeting at very high levels with the State Department and other parts of the administration, as well as with members of Congress. I don't think the U.S. necessarily believes that only through an overt military coup of this sort could they maintain control. Their issue is control and stability, relations with Israel, etc. I think that what they don't want to see is a repeat of the massive instability that comes with activism in the street on the level that we saw for 18 days during Tahrir Square last year. So I don't know that the U.S. directly is orchestrating this. What is undoubtedly true is that U.S. military and financial support has enabled the Egyptian military, has strengthened the Egyptian military, and has given them the independent power to move like this on their own. And what is clear is that so far, at least, the U.S. has done nothing to restrain them.
What would be the path forward for the Obama administration in terms of how to react to these dramatic moves by the Egyptian military that would both support democracy and stability in Egypt, as well as retaining some ties to the Egyptian military, which, of course, continues to play a very influential role in events there?
Well, I think, you know, the point of investing huge amounts of money and training and arming and all those things in militaries around the world is precisely to influence them. And this is the moment to do it. So I would say the way forward should be, if not if we're talking about what's likely, but if we're talking about what should be, what we should see is a decision by the U.S. administration to announce publicly to the Egyptian military, you know that $1.3 billion we've been giving you every year? You can kiss that goodbye until you go back to your barracks and allow the elected leadership of this country to take full power, including power over you. You don't tell an elected government what to do. They tell you what to do. And in the meantime, we're going to take that $1.3 billion and we're going to send it to the parliament so they can use it to help rebuild the country, to help recreate an economy that's not based on foreign banking interests, but is based on the interests of the Egyptian people. Now, that's idealism. That's not going to happen. But if we're looking for solutions of what could happen, what could transform this situation, that kind of major shift is what's required to match the kind of major shift that has happened in Egyptian politics, symbolized by the uprising itself.
That was Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Find more news and analysis on the turmoil surrounding Egypt's transition to democracy on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. While the Occupy Wall Street movement's emergence in New York City and around the country last fall focused attention and debate on the nation's growing income inequality over recent decades, a new report by the Federal Reserve reveals stark evidence of the damage caused by the economic meltdown. The Federal Reserve report found that from 2007 to 2010, the median net worth of American families dropped by 39%, bringing household wealth down to levels last seen in 1992. The dramatic decline in family wealth wiped out almost 20 years of accumulated savings and investments. As calculated by the Fed, an American family's median wealth decreased from $126,000 in 2007 to just $77,300 in 2010. The Federal Reserve found that middle-class families had suffered the largest losses in accumulated wealth and income during the three-year period ending in 2010. But the report revealed that poor families were also extremely hard hit, with a widening wealth gap between whites and blacks and Hispanics. The Fed attributed three-quarters of the loss in wealth to the crash of the nation's housing market, triggering a steep decline in the value of homes across most of the nation. The report's findings explain why many families across America are hesitant to spend their decreasing pool of money on small and large purchases, contributing to the sluggish economic recovery. Your reporter spoke with William K. Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, who served as the Deputy Staff Director of the National Commission which investigated the cause of the savings and loan bank failures of the 1980s and 90s. Here, Black examines the causes of the dramatic decline in American family wealth during the nation's Great Recession.
It's a median figure, so that means half is above and half is below. It's not an average or mean figure. And so in many ways, it understates the change. In other words, the average change could well be worse, but the average change you'd have to separate out, because really two things were happening. One is that normal Americans were losing, and losing enormously, but the top, in particular, 0.1% was gaining at a rate we have never seen before in this nation. So it was largely a redistribution of wealth from poorer people to the absolute richest people in America. And then there was also just plain a lot of destruction of wealth through fraud and such, again, led by our elites.
Professor Black, we can look at numbers on a piece of paper and a report like this from the Federal Reserve, but it really doesn't tell us about the real-world implications of how this set of numbers affects people and their ability to fulfill their potential in our society. You want to say a bit about how this affects people day to day?
Yeah, it has had a devastating effect in a lot of different areas. So this is happening at the same time as you have a tremendous assault on public services, particularly in the state and local governments. That utterly gratuitous series of crises, because the revenue-sharing portion of the stimulus bill was killed by a combination of conservative Democrats and Republicans. So there's been a long-term pullback in public support for universities, for example, and now this has made it far, far worse. So if you're, again, sort of a standard middle-class household and you're trying to get your kids into university, it means that it's going to cost you dramatically more, that they'll come out in debt, then they'll stay in debt for 10 years, and that they won't have a number of the programs that they wanted to take. So that's the situation for people in that bracket. For if you go farther down the bracket, there's been an enormous increase in people forced into needing food stamps. Such. So this is not just poor people, but this is working class people in America, where we have exceptional percentages of people now on food stamps. Now, part of what's going on is the so-called welfare reform under Clinton and such, and that means that there are a lot of very people who are in the marketplace who are just hanging on by their fingernails. Right, they're forced to work even if they have relatively young kids, and if they don't have health insurance, then they're always simply one illness, and not necessarily an illness for them. It can be a serious illness for one of the kids, away from being forced back into actual poverty, with the removal of most of the safety net for them until the point where they actually lose everything. At which point, you know, we will put them in a housing shelter type of thing, and we will give them emergency room care somewhat, sort of, kind of.
How do you view a set of solutions here to confront rising income inequality? Some point to a total revision of the tax code that's necessary to stop the redistribution of wealth from the poor to the wealthy. But are there other mechanisms that would be effective at reversing this trend?
Mostly what we need to do is to go back to the things that work really well and made the United States the envy of the world. So the things that work really well are, for example, having the GI Bill. And the GI Bill allowed originally pretty much all males, but it was supplemented by other programs. And essentially anybody that was very bright would be able to go to university, get their degree, and come out of school without being under crippling debt. and they could then make all kinds of wonderful advances. And that was good for the world, good for the United States, good for those people. And naturally, we decided that we should largely gut that. But I agree, you have to act on the tax code. The tax code is not only a huge part of the problem, but by the way, the Republican House just announced last week that they were going to withhold a substantial amount of funding from the IRS that would be aimed at tax evasion by the wealthiest corporations. Now, when you do this, you create what we call an economics and criminology aggressions dynamic. So the companies that cheat and avoid taxes get a huge competitive advantage over honest firms. And we now have one of the major parties actually in favor of that mechanism. They want mechanisms that continuously drive taxes for corporations and the wealthy lower and lower. They love tax havens. We have the first major candidate, I think ever, who had major accounts abroad in tax havens and will not tell the American people about them. It's just extraordinary developments in America.
That was William K. Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri and author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. For more information on the loss of family net worth and economic inequality, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On June 18th, two dozen Latino high school and college students filled a small conference room at Yale University Law School to hear some of their peers discuss President Obama's June 15th executive order stopping the deportation of undocumented immigrants between the ages of 16 and 30. Specifically, the president's directive affects immigrants without a green card who were brought to the U.S. by their parents, who've lived here continuously for at least 5 years, have no criminal record, and are in school, in the military, or are veterans. The executive order also makes these individuals eligible for working papers for the first time. The so-called grant of deferred action is valid for 2 years and can be renewed, but it does not establish a path to citizenship and is not law, so it can be reversed by any future president. One of the speakers at the Yale Law School gathering was Lorella Praley, an undocumented Peruvian immigrant who, like all the young people who call themselves Dreamers, considers herself more American than anything else. The DREAM Act, which would provide a path to citizenship for young people brought to the U.S. as children, has been introduced in Congress every year since 2001, and in 2010 came within a few votes of passage. Praley is a leader of Connecticut Students for a Dream and a member of the United We Dream National Coordinating Committee. In this talk recorded by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, she tells a bit of her personal story and gives a behind-the-scenes look at the strategy the Dreamers employed in pressuring President Obama by targeting his campaign offices for protests.
These are the faces of the people that will benefit from this, the people that this really makes a difference to. But I want to say that the reason why I do what I do, which is fight every day and try to change as many lives as possible to join the fight, is because I have a very clear understanding that nothing changes if we are not involved, that nothing changes if we are not asking for it. So my name is Lorella Praeli. I am undocumented. I am from Peru, Ica, Peru. And when I had a car accident when I was 2.5, my family sought medical treatment here in the United States. For many years, we traveled back and forth between Tampa and Peru. And my family decided to settle in the state of Connecticut when I was 10 years old. At that point, I went to middle school here, fifth grade middle school, graduated from New Milford High School, received a full ride to Quinnipiac University, and graduated last year with a degree in political science and sociology. And back in 2010, many of us were a little heartbroken. Many of us looked at the DREAM Act, many of us were in Washington, D.C. And since then, we kind of said, everyone said, nothing can happen in the next 3, 2, 5 years. In Washington, D.C., 3 months ago, we had progressives in this country telling us to just take it slow, to not apply too much pressure on President Obama because it was an election year. And I am part of Connecticut Students for a Dream, but also part of the United We Dream Network, which is the national organization that organizes youth in 37 organizations in 25 states. And we had a very different idea of what it would mean to actually change something in the United States and to bring some action into the immigrant rights movement. And that meant shifting the focus from Congress, where we know that there is a lot of Republican obstructionism at the moment, and focusing on the executive. And so the Yale Law School, I want to recognize them for a second because they were our biggest, one of our strongest allies, going in and meeting with people at the White House and really pushing for this. And they did all the work to prove that legally this was possible, alongside with 96 law professors in the country. But that aside, after recognizing it, this is a victory of the youth, the immigrant rights movement, the Dream Movement in the United States. At a moment when no one thought that we could do this, that we were too young, that we didn't have enough experience, that we didn't have policy people as part of our staff in United We Dream, we proved this country wrong. The United States is ready to recognize us. It's ready to integrate us one step farther, but we celebrate with caution. We celebrate with caution because this is not a permanent solution, because it is up to everyone in this room and the people listening and reading all of the news from here for us to actually get a permanent solution, and that it is not enough just with the dreamers. That it is also our parents, it is the friends that we know, the people who are working really hard, who are contributing in many ways, and they're not getting recognized. So I just want to say what a moment and what a great victory this has been. The last few months, especially the last week for me, has been crazy, traveling back and forth between DC and making sure that our voices are heard, that we are not taken for granted, and that our dreams are valued, respected, and now one step made possible. The world is yours. It belongs to all of us to take on this opportunity and to bring real change to the immigrant community, to the lives in the state of Connecticut and in other parts of this country. Thank you so, so much.
That was Lorella Praley, a member of the United We Dream National Coordinating Committee. Find links to more information about immigration issues on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.